So here we are. This is the first lecture on Chapter 9. And Chapter 9 is on unemployment and stagflation. The first slide says, what is the labor force? And the answer is all non-institutionalized individuals 16 years of age and older who are either working or who are looking for work. Not everyone in the United States, of course, is part of the labor force. The labor force, by definition, are those who are working or who are seeking gainful employment. A big part of what we do in economics is just definitions. So who is unemployed? Anyone 16 years of age or older who is actively seeking employment. If you're not actively seeking employment, then you're not considered unemployed. Okay, that's what we mean by a person who's unemployed. They are actively, now actively means that they're applying for jobs. It's not only that they want a job, but they're actively applying for jobs. They're seeking employment. That's what it means for being unemployed. Now, how can the unemployment rate go down, and yet that not necessarily be a good sign? Or how can more people be distressed in our society and yet the unemployment rate goes down? How is that possible? In fact, that's what's happened over the recent past. You know, the unemployment rate has actually gone down, but one of the reasons is that there's a lot of people who have simply left the workforce. You know, they've become discouraged. You know, they look for a job, and they look for a job, and they couldn't find a job, and so they quit looking. Well, they still want a job, but if they're not actively seeking a job, then we don't consider them unemployed. Okay, what is the unemployment rate? The number of unemployed individuals expressed as a percentage of the labor force. So, like, if we say that the unemployment rate is 5%, well, what does that mean? I mean, 5% of what? And the answer is 5% of the labor force. You know, not 5% of the population, but unemployment is 5% of the labor force. So how do we measure unemployment? The number of unemployed divided by the labor force. That's how we get like the 5% or the 6% or whatever. And who measures unemployment? The Bureau of Labor Statistics surveys about 60,000 households each month. Now, surveys, they do it different ways, but one common way that they do it is that they have statisticians across the country literally knocking on doors. I mean, you know, someday you might get a knock on your door, and the person says, excuse me, but can I ask you some questions? You know, I'm from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And you say, sure. And they might say, is there anyone in your household who is actively seeking employment? And you say, well, no, there's not. And then they say, well, thank you very much, and they go on their way. But if you say, well, as a matter of fact, there is, then they might say, well, do you mind if I ask you some more questions? For example, how old is this person that is seeking employment? What race is this person? What sex is this person? How long has this person been looking for work? Is this person the head of the household or not? So by asking these questions, we get a lot more in-depth information other than just a person's looking for work. Like the longship unemployment rate, persons who've been looking for work for 16 weeks or longer. See, we can have an increase in the unemployment rate, but if the longship unemployment rate is low, then we don't have a very serious situation. Why? Well, that means that, there's people losing jobs, but they're quickly finding new jobs. So with a big turnover, even though the unemployment rate may be high, it's not such a serious situation. But now if the long-term unemployment rate is high, even if the unemployment rate is lower, that's more serious. That says, well, you've got certain segments of the population here that's just been looking, and and for a long time, 16 weeks, 20 weeks, you know, a year, and they can't find a job. And likewise, there's a big difference if the head of the household is unemployed or a teenager is unemployed. You know, the statistician might say, well, if there's anyone, is anyone in his family looking for work? And you know, the father says, well, yeah, I've got a 16-year-old son who's looking for work. Well, that's one thing. Now, if he says, well, matter of fact, you know, I'm looking for work. You know, I'm the father. I've got five children. I'm unemployed. I'm looking for work. Well, that obviously that's a much more serious situation. So now when you read in the newspaper, you don't get those statistics, you just get the general unemployment rate. But if you read in more detail, then you can get a more clear picture of exactly what this statistic means. And what we're doing here in this course is we're learning to look at these things as an economist. So what is the current unemployment rate? Well, I won't go here now, but you can go to this website, and it'll tell you what the current unemployment rate is. It's somewhere between 4 and 6%, which we consider full employment. What is covered employment? Employment that qualifies for full benefits. See, there's another category. I mean, if you're looking at, how well is the economy doing in terms of employment? Well, if you've got a lot of workers who are covered, that means that they qualify for full benefits from their employer. Well, that's one thing. But if you have a lot of employees that are going, let's say, from full-time to part-time and they're non-covered, then you've got a much more serious situation. Now, you don't have to be working full-time, by the way, to be considered fully employed. You can have a part-time job working just a couple hours a week, and you can be considered unemployed. I mean, yeah, considered fully employed. So see, if you just look at that gross statistic, you know, what is the unemployment rate, it really doesn't tell you all that much unless you dig deeper and find out what the real situation is. Now, what has been happening here lately over the past year or two, especially over the past year? What has happened to the number of workers who are not covered? You think it's increased or decreased? Well, what has the new health care law done to our employment situation? Anybody know that? See, what's happening in today's workforce is that the full-time jobs, 40 hours a week, are becoming more and more rare. What's becoming more and more common are part-time jobs that are not covered. You know, part-time jobs that don't have the insurance and all the benefits that a full-time job would. And one reason for that is that starting here in just a couple months, if you're a company of over a certain size, and for every employee that is working more than 30 hours a week, if you don't provide them with full insurance, then you pay a penalty. Now that's just starting in a couple months, January 2015. So what are a lot of corporations doing? They're what? Yeah, they're cutting back people's hours. You know, instead of having one full-time employee working 40 hours, they might have two part-time employees working 20 hours. So we're going from a situation, a workforce that is primarily fully covered to a workforce that is primarily uncovered, because there more of the workforce is part-time without the benefits as opposed to full-time with benefits. Now, of course, who is affected most by this economic change? Come on now. Obviously you are, right? You are. It's new people graduating from college or high school that's, you know, wanting to get into the workforce, but hey, there's hardly any full-time jobs available. You can get a part-time job, perhaps, but there are, you know, much fewer full-time jobs. You know, all organizations are being greatly affected by this. Colleges are being greatly affected by this by adjunct professors. It's very colleges have been cutting back on their adjunct professors because they're if they hire a professor and it can be categorized as more than 30 hours a week, then they've got to pay all this money that they didn't have to pay before. And so they say, well, we can't afford that. I mean, if we kept our current adjunct professors as many as before, we'd go broke. And so what are they doing? Well, they're simply limiting the hours that adjunct professors can teach to get underneath that 30-hour a week threshold. It's very significant, and it's greatly, greatly affecting our workforce, this the new healthcare law. Now, of course, there's some people that benefit from the healthcare law. I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad law overall, it has changed. The healthcare law has changed the workforce. And that's what we're talking about here. See, now what is a discouraged worker? A person who has dropped out of labor force due to a lack of success in finding a job. See, we don't count the discouraged worker as being unemployed. And so you can have an economy with a lot of discouraged workers who would like to have a job, but they can't find a job, but yet we don't count them as unemployed. Okay, thanks. Yeah, he told me he had to leave early, and there's a few more that have to leave early, so I do appreciate that when you, you know, tell me you have to leave early. And here goes another one. Okay. I appreciate that. Are discouraged workers considered a part of the labor force? No, people who quit looking for work are not considered a part of the labor force. All right. What about part-time workers? Part-time workers are considered fully employed. So, see, we can go from a primarily a full-time workforce to a part-time workforce and yet still, you know, have full employment. At least statistically, although in reality there's a big difference. Now, what is underemployment? A situation in which workers are overqualified for their jobs or work fewer hours than they would prefer. We call that underemployment. Like you go to college and you get an undergrad degree, and then you get a master's degree, and then you get a PhD, and you still can't find a job, and you end up flipping burgers at McDonald's. Well, obviously, I mean, if you got a PhD and you're flipping burgers at McDonald's, you're underemployed. And that is something that's growing in today's situation. See, unfortunately, there's been such an emphasis on students, you know, of people your age to go to college because you've been told that a college degree is desirable, and everything else being equal, it is desirable as opposed to not having one. But what's happened as a result? Well, what's happened as a result is you've got more competition. I mean, when there's more people with college degrees, then what happens to the value of a college degree in the workforce? It's like everything else. You know, when something becomes more plentiful, what happens? Well, the price goes down, right? When things become easier to come by, then the price goes down. Well, if you're talking about professions and jobs, then, you know, the more people with college degrees, then the less value that degree is. And that often leads to underemployment. It also leads, by the way, to lower wages. You know, there's still in America, the average person with a college degree is going to earn considerably more than a person with a high school degree. I mean, that's just a fact. But there are some countries where they have driven, like Japan, for example, or Germany, they've driven so many young people into college as opposed to maybe trade schools, and you got so many college degrees that people with, on the average, people with college degrees sometimes make less than high school graduates, or they make less certainly than people that go into the trades. You know, we're crying, even in America, we're crying for people that are skilled in the trades, you know, plumbers and electricians and people like that. I mean, you know, those type occupations pay very well, and we have a shortage. But yet, what happens? Well, because of pressure put upon you, there's more of you that say, well, I want to get a college degree, without really considering the value of that college degree. And by the way, does it make any difference what you major in? Well, it makes a big difference what you major in. You know, there's some majors that are very marketable, and there are other majors that aren't marketable at all. But sometimes universities don't really divulge that full information to you, because they'll offer anything where students will sign up for. And if enough students are interested in, you know, European art, then they'll offer lots of courses in European art. But how many of those students are going to get jobs when they graduate? Especially, what's that? Well, that's true. Their volume over there is very low, but I did catch what you were saying, that there's some professions where more advanced degrees are very marketable, like some of the ones you mentioned are physical therapy and nursing. That needs help, yeah. The health, especially in like in the healthcare field, right? We've got the baby boom generation. You know, I'm part of the baby boom generation. You know, people born, after World War II, starting in 1946 through about 1952, 54, and there's a big. It's just kind of like if you ever seen a picture of a boa constrictor swallowing a pig or something. I mean, you know, they can swallow these animals whole.
What?
Yeah, and the volume just went way up over there.
I got the A lung and all of a sudden just get like that.
Oh, okay.
That's weird.
Yeah, now I can really hear you. the boa constrictor, sometimes will swallow whole animals. And you can see the animal work its way through the boa constrictor over a couple weeks. Because, you know, boa constrictors eat like once a month. But they nourish on whatever they eat through that month. And you can actually see it go through its body. And that's kind of like what the baby boom generation is here in the United States. There's a lot of people born, and it's kind of like a bubble. And it's moved its way through the economy. Of course, what's happened? Well, now those people are in their mid-60s, and they're beginning to retire. And it's just statistically, people that are older have more health problems than young people. And so what she's saying over there in Dublin is that there's, you know, today and in the future, there's going to be more need for healthcare workers because of the baby boomers are retiring and getting older and having a lot of health problems.
Well, plus everybody dies, so there's always a need. The same thing for morticians. There's always a need.
Oh, mortician, yeah. You know, that's another good point. That's a very good point. What he's saying is that if you go into something where you know there's going to be a need of, like morticians, you know, people are always going to die, so you're always going to need morticians. And that's one of those other fields, how many college grads go into being a mortician? But yet, you know, that's a good field to go into.
But it's also a field that's not the best, and there's not a lot of people going for it, like you said, but it's always needed, and that's why it's a high-demand job.
The high-demand job. You know what? One of the highest-paying occupations are one of the highest-paying occupations in America, where over half of them are millionaires. You know what that occupation that is? One of the most profitable occupations are auctioneers. Auctioneers, half of all auctioneers have become millionaires. Now, that's a high statistic. I mean, how many jobs can you go into where over 50% will end up millionaires? And yet, how many of you are training to be an auctioneer? Yeah. Are y'all find this interesting?
Yeah.
In fact, in my personal finance course, one of the things I teach is that, you know, one of the rules of becoming financially successful is that you look, see what most people are doing, and then you do the opposite. That's been proven time and time again. Just look at what most people are doing and then do the opposite. Interesting. I mean, if most people are simply going to college and just picking a degree that they think are interested in and you know, getting a degree in, you know, in whatever, social science or philosophy or something, well, you know, I mean, in fact, what you can do is that you can go on a monster board and play what-if games. See, what if I got a college degree in this or in that? You know, where are the jobs? How much do they pay? And, you know, you can play what-if games on these sites on the Internet where, you know, people apply for jobs. I mean, you should, you know, especially, you know, this is a sophomore course. And it's exactly as a sophomore that you have to start making some of the most important decisions of your life. Because the first 2 years was a no-brainer. I mean, you just took, you know, basic English, history, the sciences, you know, the courses you took were laid out for you. But after you're a sophomore, once you become a junior, well, then you got to declare a major. And whatever you declare as a major is going to determine the rest of your life. A hugely important decision. And yet, how many people simply decide to major in something that they're interested in? Now, I'm not saying you should go into things that you're not interested in, but that's a poor reason to choose a major, because that's a business decision. I mean, that's going to determine your lifestyle for the rest of your life. So you got to take it serious. And you shouldn't be tied to just, well, you know, what your friends are doing. I mean, you know, look into other fields that are not so popular, like being a mortician or being an auctioneer. Anyway, hope some of you take that to heart, because it certainly ties in with the subject of this chapter, right? The subject of this chapter is the workforce. The subject of this chapter is employment and unemployment. So I hope you take that to heart. So what is the labor force participation rate, the ratio of the number in the labor force to the adult population? So what happens when the labor force participation rate drops? Well, we've got a serious situation then. You know, that means that you've got the population. Now, what percentage of your population is in the workforce? Well, if the percentage of your population that is in the workforce diminishes, then that's a bad omen. That's a bad situation. And that's what's happening in America today. What percentage of the labor force is female? Almost half, or probably, well, you know, pretty close, 50-50.
That was different 50 years ago, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was, very much so. You know, that's a good point. I think, you know, I appreciate you bringing that up. That's something that's changed over certainly the past 50 years or even the last 20 years. Now, many of you are too young to really realize that change because a lot of you were born and raised up in an era where, you know, maybe the majority of, you know, wives and mothers were in the workforce. But, you know, like in my generation, you know, when I was your age, it was a rarity for you know, mothers to be in the workforce. But that's something that changed during the 70s. You know, we talked about that. It was the stagflation of the 70s that drove a lot of families were faced with a lower living standard because of unemployment and inflation. And so the answer was the second income. And that, you know, greatly changed society. And, you know, another interesting statistic is that, I mean, what percentage of students at New River are female? About 60%. In that nationwide, the majority of college students are female. Mm-hmm. It's about 60-40.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. There are several reasons for that. One reason is, okay, thanks. Yeah, he also told me he had to leave early. You know, one reason that there are many jobs available to men that aren't available to women, or sometimes the reason is just because of the physical strength necessary, and sometimes it's just, you know, tradition, you know, societies. But there's a lot of heavy construction jobs and, you know, other type jobs, you know, heavy factory type jobs, you know, that are predominantly male. And so in order for women to get a good paying job, well, more of them have to go and get a skill and a college degree to, you know, get a good paying job. More, you know, more so than men. So that, you know, that's one reason why, you know, more. And of course, another reason is that so what is the divorce rate today?
I believe it's almost, it's
about
50%.
Yeah, it's about 50% too. And so what that means is that there's, you know, there was a time when divorce was a rarity, that you know, that girls could, you know, they would be married and they would become mothers and they would be, you know, not worried about ever being on their own and, you know, getting divorced. Where today, you know, that's more on the minds of women. And so they say, well, you know, in order to protect myself from being impoverished in the future, I'm going to go and get a college degree. So that's another reason. How important that is, I don't know, but it's somewhat of a factor in the fact that there's more females in college than there are males.
So in a way, if you think about it, women being able to go into the workforce is possibly one of the reasons for higher rate of divorce.
Well, that could be too. Yeah, I mean, you could make a point to that. Yeah.
That they don't need a man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That there could be a tie-in. You bet. You know how much? I don't know, but yeah, you've got a point there. Now, what are the types of unemployment? Well, there are different types of unemployment: frictional, structural, seasonal, and cyclical. So we're going to look at each one. So what is frictional unemployment? Unemployment that arises because of the time needed to match job seekers with job openings. Now, frictional unemployment, another way of looking at it, is the normal job search type of unemployment. In other words, is it possible for us to have 0% unemployment? Is that possible? Is it possible for us to have 0% unemployment? No, that's impossible. Why is it impossible?
Someone's always looking for a job.
And why is someone always looking for a job? Well, are we always going to have high school and college graduates graduating, you know, after they graduate and they start looking for a job? Is that normal? Yeah, that's normal. Is it normal for some people to lose their jobs because maybe the company they work for goes out of business? I mean, is that normal even in the best economy? A certain amount of that, sure. It could be for a variety of reasons. It could be the business is poorly run. It could be it's the market has changed. It could be that it's selling something. It's no longer marketable. I mean, you know, it may be a typewriter business, and people don't buy typewriters anymore, and things like that, you see. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why, I don't know the statistic on this, but I wish I didn't know the statistic. Maybe someone out there does, but, how many different jobs does a person, the average person in America, have over their lifetime? And I think I could be wrong on this, but it's about 7.
I was thinking 6 to 9.
Yeah, 6 to 9, somewhere around it, somewhere around that time frame. I mean, I've got two children, and one is an accountant, and one is a computer programmer, and they're both, let's see, on their fourth or fifth jobs. And that's, in those fields especially, that's just normal. Anyway, so what frictional unemployment is you say, okay, we got all these people that graduate from college, they're looking for work. We got some people working for these companies, and they either cut back their workforce because of various reasons, or they go out of business for various reasons, but those people are now looking for work. Is it normal for people to become dissatisfied with their job and say, I want to do something else in life, and I'm going to quit my job, maybe go back to school, and then I'll re-enter the workforce? I mean, is that a certain amount of that? Is that normal?
Yeah.
But see, what I'm saying is that there's all kinds of reasons in the best economy where people would be looking for work. So we say to ourselves, okay, all of this is what we call frictional unemployment. You know, the normal job search type of unemployment is what we call frictional unemployment. So, how much of the workforce would be unemployed, and we say, well, that's just normal. And economists have come up with somewhere between 4 and 6%. See, it's impossible to have 0% unemployment, or 1%, or 2%, okay, or maybe even 3%. I mean, these numbers aren't exact, but economists say if we have an unemployment rate of somewhere between 4 and 6%, then, well, that's just normal. So we're going to call that full employment. See, we can have 4% unemployment, but we would say, well, that's full employment. See, full employment isn't 0% unemployment. Otherwise, we would never have full employment. Y'all see what I mean? Now, if we have 8% unemployment or 10% unemployment, well, now, 10% unemployment, maybe that's 4% more than what we consider the higher end of being normal. And now maybe we got a problem. Okay, why will people, in the workforce, in the best of times, graduates, job advancement, downsizing, weak markets, that's what we just talked about. I do get ahead of myself sometime on these slides. What is structural unemployment? Unemployment that arises because the skills demanded by employers do not match those of the unemployed. There's a situation in America where many American businesses need certain skills and certain level of education in certain areas. And for whatever the reason, a good portion of those people are foreigners. All right? In other words, corporations in America are crying for a certain type of skills that the American workforce are not providing. And they therefore hire foreigners because they're more skilled people in those areas in foreign countries. And yet the immigration laws in America make it very difficult sometimes for American companies to hire foreigners. And so a lot of these highly skilled jobs are simply going vacant, and which is a drag on our productivity and our growth here in America. Now, whatever that reason is, you know, I don't know. I mean, Americans, for example, by and large, are not enough of you go into physics and mathematics and, you know, those type fields. More Americans go into the social sciences. Anyway, that's just the way it is. And but that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about, you know, the workforce and you know, what is the workforce and what causes unemployment. Anyway, structural unemployment is when the skills demanded by employers do not match those of the unemployed. In other words, there are jobs available here, but we can't find skilled people to fill the jobs. Now, that's an example of structural unemployment. You know, the economy has changed structurally and is in need of certain skills, but the workforce has not kept up or have not changed so that they can fulfill the needs of those highly skilled jobs. And that's a big factor in America today. The other is that the unemployed do not live where the jobs are. For an example, I've talked about this before. I mean, if you want a job tomorrow paying $100,000 a year, and I'm saying you right now, your age, your level of education, you could quit school and next week have a job guaranteed making over $100,000 a year. Now, where is that? South Dakota and those neighboring states. They're in an energy boom, and they're crying for workers.
They're coming back to this area. They don't have 100 years now.
Well, what's that? Yeah, you mean, yeah, that is common. What's common is that a lot of people are going out there and working for maybe a week and then coming back, you know, maybe to Virginia and then going back there and working another couple of weeks. And, you know, that is a phenomena in today's workforce. Or they might go out there and work for 6 months and you know, make, you know, $50,000, $60,000 and then come back home for 6 months. I mean, that's also happening today. Now, what is preventing a lot of people from doing that? Well, it's preventing a lot of unemployed people from doing that is that there are so many people today that are upside down in their mortgages. Now, what does it mean to be upside down in your mortgage? That means you owe more in the house than what the house is worth on the market. And see, there was a time, and that time is coming back, by the way. You know, there was a time, one of the things that led to the financial collapse of 2007-2008 was that the authorities, you know, the banking industry and government made it so easy for people to borrow money to buy a house. In fact, you know, when George Bush the second, you know, was a president, I just watched a video the other day, you know, and he's talking about how the American dream is for people to own their own homes, and so the government is doing this and doing that so more people can own their homes. Well, philosophically, you know, that sounds good, but what happened? Well, what happened is that when people buy homes with no down payment and the price of those homes go down, you know, like if you borrow money to buy a house that's worth $200,000 with no down payment and the house falls in value to only $150,000, well, even if you sold the house and got $150,000, you'd still be in debt by $50,000. See, that's what's called being upside down on the mortgage. And with more people being upside down on their mortgage, that limits labor mobility. You know, there are jobs out west, but a lot of people can't go out west because they can't afford to monetarily. And that's a factor in today's workforce. Now, what I say is that those times are coming back. All right, I've been reading several articles lately that where the government and the banking authorities are once again making it much easier for people to obtain a mortgage. And, of course, a lot of people, you know, so much of economics, especially Keynesian economics, is based on the premise that people are rational. And an Austrian, see, this is one big difference between Austrians and Keynesians. You know, Keynesians always assume that people are rational. That even if you make it easier for people to borrow money to buy a house, they're not going to do it unless it makes financial sense. See, that's being rational. Whereas Austrians would say, you know, lots of times people make very irrational decisions. You know, lots of times people will, I mean, back in the, you know, 2004, 2005, people were borrowing huge amounts of money and not even afford to move in the house the first month. I mean, it's incredible what people do. You know, people do very irrational things very often. Anyway, that's one of the big differences between Keynesians and Austrians. But one reason for structural unemployment, you see, I mean, in other words, if you make it easier for people to buy a mortgage, and now a lot of people are upside down in a mortgage, well, that is a structural change. See, the economy has changed structurally when things like this happen. And if there's people unemployed, where, you know, if they were more mobile, they could be fully employed, but they're unemployed because they can't move, well, that's maybe because of a change in the economy structurally. So we call that structural unemployment. Now, what is seasonal unemployment? Unemployment caused by seasonal shifts in labor supply and demand. So, you know, like carpenters may be fully employed in summer, but come January, February, especially if they live in the northern states, you know, like Michigan, you know, they might become unemployed because of the weather. You know, I mean, there's, so, you know, some jobs do well during certain times of the year and others not. And so we call that seasonal unemployment. And that's a factor. Now, what is cyclical unemployment? Unemployment that fluctuates with the business cycle, increasing during recessions and decreasing during expansions. In other words, there are some jobs that are more susceptible to economic downswings than other jobs. You know, like you might go into the construction field, but you got to realize that the construction field is very susceptible to swings in the business cycle. You know, the housing market is one of the first hit when the economy starts to head south. So there are some jobs that may pay very well when the business cycle is on the high side, but they're the first affected once the economy starts to head south, which is going to happen. I mean, is it normal and inevitable for things to get better and worse and full employment and unemployment and recessions? And is that normal?
Yes,
that's totally normal. Totally normal. That, you know, whether you like it or not, that's going to happen. So people that go into these jobs should know that, you know, some jobs are more affected by the business cycle than others. You know, like in some jobs are actually work the other way. Like my job, for example, my job is more secure the worse the economy gets. How come that is?
Because there's less people being able to go to work.
And therefore...
more people are coming to college to get another degree.
Yeah, exactly. When the economy goes south, our enrollment here at New River goes up. So anyway, we call the, you know, not all jobs are equal in this manner. And we call that, you know, when people become unemployed because of changes in the business cycle, we call that cyclical unemployment. It's a type of unemployment. So what is full employment? I've already mentioned the level of employment when there is no cyclical unemployment. So in other words, all these other areas that I talked about other than cyclical unemployment are could be categorized as, well, just normal job search during the ups and downs, the natural ups and downs of, you know, the business cycle. And that's where we get, you know, that between 3 and 5%. You know, if 3 to 5% of the workforce is unemployed, well, we still call that full employment. What is considered full employment? Okay. This I got ahead of myself here. 4 to 6% unemployment is considered full employment. Okay. Why 4 to 6%? Because even in the best of times, some people are always looking for work. So it's a matter of definition. Definition. See, a lot of what we do in economics is a matter of definition. What would make unemployment increase beyond 6%? Excessive inventories. Now, first of all, what is inventory? Inventory are goods that are produced but not yet sold. And all businesses need inventory. You know, when you go shopping at Walmart, all those items on the shelves are inventory. So inventory is not a bad thing, okay? All businesses need inventory. But the problem is when that inventory becomes excessive. You know, like if a business is producing 1,000 widgets a week and they're selling 1,000 widgets a week, and they have 500 widgets in the warehouse at all times. See, well, they got an inventory of 500 in the warehouse, and they're producing 1,000 or selling 1,000, and everything is cool. Now, if demand drops to where people are only buying 600 widgets a week, it may take time for this business to realize, oh, people are demanding less. Well, what tells a business that people are demanding less? Well, what tells a business that people are demanding less is that the inventory in the warehouse starts to build. Instead of having 500 widgets, now they got 700. And the next month they got 1,000. And the next month they got 1,500. Now, how long is a business going to keep on producing while they're looking at their inventory in the warehouse becoming excessive? I mean, what's a business going to do after when they realize this?
Slow down production.
And when they slow down production, that means they need fewer resources. And one of the fewer resources they need less of is
employees.
So I ask you a question. What causes unemployment? And the answer is excessive inventory. Period. That's what causes unemployment. That's why a business will lay off workers when their inventory becomes excessive. Now, what causes that excessive inventory? Well, now you've got all kinds of answers. Okay, well, I mean, we'll talk about these later, but you know, you've got all kinds of answers there. But it all leads to the same place that causes the unemployment. It all, the central reason is excessive inventory. Okay? Now, sometimes we use the word surplus. You know, we have a surplus. But more specifically, economists like to use the term excessive inventory because that's more exact in what it really is. See, what is the current unemployment rate? Well, again, I'm not sure. If you go to this website, you could find it.
Between 3% to 6%, hopefully.
Well, let me see if this works, because it's time to go anyway. Let's see. Hey, this might work.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it did work. Let's see. The forecast for December 2015 is 7%. Well, that's not. That's a ways away yet. Well, anyway, it looks like it's about 7%. Now, down here we got ...2012 it was 8%, 2011 9%, 2010 was 9.6%. Now, keep in mind that, you know, we can look at these figures, you know, what's the unemployment rate, but how exact are these figures? I mean, you know, do these figures consider the discouraged worker, for example? No, they don't. See, in other words, but like any other statistic, even though there are weaknesses in how we calculate the statistic, as long as we calculate it the same way month after month, year after year, then despite the weaknesses, can we at least get a comparison of what's happening from one time period to the next? In other words, why do we have these statistics? We have these statistics because we want to know where we're going and how fast we're going there. We want to know, are things getting better or are things getting worse? So even though there are weaknesses in these statistics, as long as we're consistent in how we calculate them, then we can at least ascertain, oh, things are getting better or things are getting worse. And we can get a pretty good idea of, oh, how quickly are they getting better or how quickly are they getting worse? Okay, and that's true for any government statistic, all right? Anyway, it's time to go. So we'll pick this up next time. Thank you.